You're listening to Red Setter, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
G'day and welcome to this week's Red Center. I'm Mike Seymour and I'm here in the presence of one Jason Wingrove. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, Mike. How are you?
I'm good. Excellent. I'm very good, actually.
Excellent.
Had a good reaction to our show last week.
Yes.
Thank you guys for that. Yeah, we're sorry that went long. We're going to go short this week to make up. But yes. Having said that, yes, there was a good reaction to our interview with Anthony. I should tell you guys a funny story. I was respectfully suggesting to Jason he might like to do that interview because I knew how much he liked the work of Anthony Dodd-Mantle, and not that I didn't want to do it because I thought it was great, but I was like saying to Jace, well, you should do it. And Jace was being like all polite, like
he said I should do it with about 20 minutes to go.
No, I said it okay 50 times before that.
Yes, true.
But then finally I said, look, you should do it, man, you should really do it. And so then Jace goes, yep, I'll do it.
And then it was just an absolute clusterfuck of an afternoon. I tell you, I had school kid interviews, had to go grab dinner, and Skype wouldn't work. And I thought, oh, I just saw this Academy Award winner in my mind sitting on the edge of the bed in his luxury hotel room, staring at the phone, not ringing. And I thought, no, Mike, I can't. It's too hard. And then I knew I'd get, if I finally got everything working and Skype working, I'd be on the phone and go,
So what's really funny about that is that so I deactivated from interview mode and was just about to get into some tequila shots or something when you went, actually, no.
I can't. I'm sorry.
So the fact you guys liked the interview was great. But I guess the thing is both of us were big fans of his work and of the film itself, so it was pretty easy to do that. I should also say that we want to thank the Australian Cinematographer Society because not only did they help organise that, but then they organised the screenings that were sponsored by Fuji Film, and one of those was something that I went to last Friday night, which was great. And I wanted to mention it only because I had another chat with Anthony before the presentation of the film and his Q&A session. And we discussed something else that I, Jace, hadn't managed to get to in the interview. You probably would have, had you made it to the interview, thought to ask this. But we so often don't talk about audio. And it just struck me as I was driving out to the screening that how the heck did they get the audio happening on the sequences that they're running through the... And he told me this funny story. He said that they really didn't get the audio very well, though, as we, you know, could imagine, and you'd certainly know from working with children, it's really hard to get kids to post, what do you call it, post lip sync or...
Yeah, post sync or whatever, ADR.
Yeah. Yes. So the main boy, who obviously becomes a central character as he gets older, was okay for doing that, but the other kids weren't.
Right.
And
so it was all the more important that they got it on the day.
But it was really hard because the gyro made noise and stuff. And
yeah, the gyro on the bottom of the camera would have made a heck of a noise, as they do.
And so anyway, the second week... because they weren't really getting it. The second week, they hired this new sound recordist. And so this is Anthony explaining to me. It's like, and so then I'm there on set, and I didn't even notice the sound guys. You know what I mean? Like, they just didn't go near me. They were completely... I mean, I assumed that they were recording audio, but I never saw them.
Yeah,
then we hired this new guy.
I'm about their names. Fabulous.
And I'm about to record, and suddenly this guy starts yelling, mobile phones off! Stop what you're doing! And he's like, who the hell is that on my set?
I'll take that.
And they'd hired this new sound recordist, who's like the number one sound recordist in India, who everybody apparently is scared of. And all of a sudden, everybody did what he wanted, and they started getting good sound.
Wow.
And occasionally on set, I guess you just need a force for good.
Yeah, yeah. Sound is just so important. It's one of those things that if you have a bad one, you know about it. And the good ones are the ones that just you don't, apart from shouting, that you don't know they're there. They don't. The boom doesn't get in shot. They're not holding you up, replacing batteries on wireless mics every 3 seconds. They just get on with it and get out of your way.
Though I should also fess up, maybe it was the overtly sycophantic nature of my inherent presence, or maybe it was just the addition of alcohol, but we started discussing shots that I really liked from the film. And one of the ones I was discussing is when the blind boy gets the $100 bill.
Yep.
What I didn't know, and I hope Anthony doesn't mind me telling the story, is that they filmed that, and the guy that was doing the noisy spraying of insect stuff, that was real. That was somebody actually doing that, and they were like, oh, we should get that and use that. But they shot that, Anthony shot that, and the camera failed. Like, they lost a whole lot of takes. And so what you see in the film is a third what Anthony shot,
right?
And or maybe a half. And the other bit is a second unit DOP that had to go back and reshoot what Anthony had got. And Anthony said, I think I'm right in saying this, that he actually teared up when they were filming it the first time. And so he was destroyed when this wasn't actually usable footage. So, you know, just a word of warning.
Yeah.
If you want to live on the bleeding edge, sometimes it actually really hurts.
Oh, look, it can happen with film as well, you know. Scratches, neck scratches, and hairs and gates that you don't spot on the day.
So, in secondary follow up news, following up on our shooting using the red camera to shoot covers of Esquire magazine for gratuitous reasons, I posted a link to this on Twitter. But Chase, you've got it for the show notes.
Yes, there's a link to a not brilliant video. There is, if you dig around on the net, there is someone who's got a much better quality, but it is actually straight through to someone's .mac account, so I'm not going to post that here because they'll just end up getting stung bandwidth-wise. But I've got links in the show notes. I think if you go esquire.com/Megan, I think is the link that leads you to the video. It's pretty bloody simple, actually. There's a lot of fuss about, you know, just Megan Fox getting out of bed and...
The thing that I thought was...
opening a beer and starting the barbecue and hanging around by the pool.
Yeah.
It's quite odd.
The thing that I thought watching this is I don't want to be an actor doing this kind of work. I don't want to have my wife or daughter be an actress that does this kind of work. Like, it suddenly went from being a photo shoot to being quite, I don't know, voyeuristic. I'd actually felt quite uncomfortable watching her.
Well, that's interesting then. That's good. I mean, it's good that it made you feel that way then. That's quite
good. Don't you think? It was a bit like you're invading someone's privacy. It was like, it's like you got to shoot and then they're filming it. And then it's like, well, I don't want this filmed.
Yeah. It felt filmed to me. But and she was sort of, just too beautifully going through the motions to just be that casual. But it's great that it made you feel that way. That's terrific with such a simple setup, which looks like not lit, just very, very naturally shot, that it makes you feel like you're invading on her boudoir.
I felt quite uncomfortable watching that. I understand that actresses/models get to earn a living from lounging around in lingerie. It just seems like the less professional, something side of the game. It just seems really creepy to pay someone to hang out in their lingerie and then film them when they're an actress that does acting. I don't know.
Well, that's good with probably, two makeup and hair people standing right off camera and, a camera assistant and a camera operator and all that
gaffer
people in the room
that
she still came off as being
true. My uncomfort is probably
natural.
A testament. This is the director speaking here. You're the director being saying that it's really good that I felt uncomfortable that it looked that natural.
That's good. The power of well,
I just
power
felt
of film,
creepy.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, you have we don't have a lot of big red news this week.
We don't
week.
Have any news really. Partly to do with the fact that Jim is off getting married. She obviously said that it's time to tie the knot. His girlfriend's been very patient with the whole red stuff, and one of the main reasons he did red was to prove to her that Oakley was not just a lucky mistake, was not just this lucky company. So he wanted to make her proud of something he was doing, so started red, which is pretty interesting.
So this
insight.
Is what he does to
this is what he does to impress
girlfriend.
Women.
Yeah, what would he do to impress his kids? Do you know what I mean? If he has kids, I want to see that, because I would do anything to get the your kids looking up to you and thinking you actually did something useful.
So he says that if you're happy with Red, then she deserves a lot of credit for motivating him to stay young and take another big swing. So
not having much of a home life. Because, quite frankly, he's been working crazy hours. Mm, they all have.
Absolutely. I mean, he's always there posting at all hours. And, every time you see those renders, take it for what they are, but he's often the one in, those guys are the ones doing it. It's not some team of, 3D grunts in the, high on Red Bull at 3 in the morning. It's, you've got the bosses of the company out there doing it hands-on. So that's interesting. So, yes, go ahead. Get married. Congratulations.
But it's a fairly small wedding. We're not invited.
No, it's a very small wedding. Just 6 people. How many people you can fit in a Cessna Citation and head off to some island somewhere.
Okay. I had more than six people at my wedding, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people that wish Jim well, but yes, we don't... Again, we're in the creepy zone. I don't want to be the guy that's just commenting on people's private lives.
No, no.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I would actually keep that very separate myself.
Yeah. No, look, I mean, as I say, as part of moving on from the whole Red thing and expanding our horizons as we are, I'll sort of... I think I'll probably slowly drift away from... Unless it's something amazing, we'll sort of drift away from the whole... Yeah, ins and outs of micro events in the Red world, and leave that all to Red Crack if you want to hear about it, and we'll perhaps move on into...
Yeah, if there's something seriously useful, we'll obviously
of course.
Heavily get into it.
Absolutely. But I think I'll sort of drift away a little bit, and we'll obviously get stuck into the big stuff, but we'll move on for little things like that.
Now, what we're going to do this week is... I'm not prepared to do the workflow part for this week. I'm sorry, I'm just not. I've got some other stuff coming, and I want to get that in before I do it. So that'll be next week. What we're going to do this week is two things. We're going to have a bit of a chat, actually, about the Phantom camera, because we thought it'd be interesting to have a look at in comparison to Red to some other CMOS-based cutting-edge cameras that are doing high-res stuff or high-speed stuff. And so we were lucky enough to spend some time with the Phantom, so we thought we'd have a look at that. And then we're going to get into a really good interview that that you did, Jose. You want to tell us about what that's coming up later in the show?
Well, I've been sort of banging on for some time about probably the best thing I've seen on TV for a long time, which is a documentary series called Carrier. And it's a six-month shoot. They're embedded on the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier. And it's an incredible insight into life on board. And what I love about it was the fact that it was not a boys' own annual sort of thing of, wow, cool jets and all the tech. It was about the people. There's 5,000 people on board. The average age is 19.
There were some pretty interesting comments in that, weren't there? One about the prison, but that's all...
Yeah. Anyway, but so I spoke to Axel Baumann, one of the lead cinematographer on that shoot, and the perils of shooting on board an aircraft carrier for 6 months. That's a great chat, and that's coming up.
But don't worry, even though this is a slightly unread Red centre, it's not like we're completely moving away from the world of Red. And, of course, we'll continue to have great interviews with people in the Red Room and follow on workflows. And if you have a Red project that you'd like to talk to us about, we get regular emails from people, please do send us a... we actually really love getting emails from you guys. We got quite a few in-depth ones. Somebody this week, for example, emailed us at red@fxguide.com about discussing comparison between, say, Red and some of the digital SLR cameras and trends there, because, of course, there's an interesting merge going on as we move into Red Stage 2 and Scarlett Epic, and they
definitely are,
of course, designed to have stills. So that's going to be coming up in future weeks. But
definitely do that.
Right now, let's swing our attention to a little bit of gear news, and then we'll have our discussion about the Phantom camera.
Look,
for it.
Well, this is actually anti-gear. This is gear I just... What the fuck? Okay, sorry to drop the F-bomb, but man, this I cannot get my head around this piece of equipment. Now, dearly, I want somebody to get back to me, email me, and apologies if you are the people behind this piece of equipment, but I just cannot see the merit, okay? I know it's sort of possibly a waste of airtime, but it's still an interesting piece of tech. Now, what I'm talking about here is essentially called the V3 depth-enhancing image system. Essentially what it is like a rear adapter that would go on the back of your... standard lens. It's primarily designed for, I think, probably for... Well, they've got a few versions. They've got something for video, like to suit 2/3-inch images, and a 35mm film version. Essentially, it's like an adapter you'd put on the back between your lens and your camera. And what they're plugging it as... let me read this. A visually compelling new imaging technology that produces enhanced depth, shape, texture, and realism in HD video, 35mm film, streaming media... mobile video, video games, you name it, and can be viewed on all standard displays without the need of special viewing equipment, including 3D glasses. V3 images are produced through a series of hardware and software products. Well,
so
okay.
So this thing is... this thing okay, look, meant to enhance the sense of depth.
Okay. Now, what they're doing, and again, if you're involved in this tech and you, and I'm getting this wrong, please get back to me. Essentially, what it's doing is you on your taking lens, you open up the iris. Forget the iris, using the iris on the lens. It has an inbuilt iris in it, essentially. And what it's essentially doing is replacing the camera's iris, the lens's iris, with this iris in the unit. And essentially, looks like it's essentially oscillating the iris, like going around in little circles. If you go to, let me just see what the web.
So in other words, they're vibrating in an XY plane.
Yes.
The actual whole aperture.
Exactly. The aperture is sort of, the aperture behind the lens is essentially just doing a little gentle sort of oscillating circle.
If something's being picked up by the center of the lens, it's not going to be affected theoretically, right? Because it never changes, yeah, because anything coming through the center of the lens, the center is always open.
Well, you see how like the shape of the iris in a lens and its sort of design in a lot of ways dictates the bokeh and dictates the look of the out of focus images, the background images. This essentially seems to be kind of gently oscillating the background, if that makes sense. The person in foreground, the person in the focal plane, seems to be quite stable, but it essentially slowly wobbles the background and almost giving you a little look to the left of the person and the look to the right of the person. It's almost like it's an oscillating, not an oscillating shift lens, but it's essentially look. You get this gentle look slightly to the left and to the right of somebody. So what it to me looks like, and if you go to this website, INV3.com, again, there's links to the show notes. You can see plenty of clips of this stuff working, none of which I can understand what the hell is going on with it or where the amazing visually compelling stuff is. Again, it looks to me essentially just to be wobbling the background or wobbling the bokeh and shimmering the highlights around.
You're speechless. Except you're not, because you're outraged.
I'm just kind of outraged that people are sort of, you know, plugging this kind of weird snake oil kind of pseudo optical bullshit, really, that and plugging it as being, I mean, someone's come up with this idea and has run full head on with it, creating a 35mm version, video, a plug-in for gaming, plug-in for mobile phones.
Must be what I'd like to see, and I haven't seen it on the website, is a before and after. If they did a split screen?
Yeah, you'd need to sort of see a bit of a split screen to see what it does, because essentially you have to look really hard to sort of work out what the heck's going on.
Interestingly, I had a similar, smaller version of that myself. Somebody was raving to me about a thing called the mic thing, which is like a baffling device to put around this microphone.
Yes.
Huge thing, right?
Right, yes. Wall in front of you.
And it's on the floor over there now.
Oh,
We got it up and we tested it extensively.
Mic thing.
And I've got to say that when we tested it extensively, everybody which was a limited poll of three people, were like, yep, I think I can tell that it's pretty close. I think B is definitely better. And I'm like, well, that's B without it.
Right, conclusive.
I was like, well, emotionally, I can connect with this being a good idea.
Yeah.
And physically, it looks cool. Great. And actually, it doesn't actually sound a whole lot better.
That little bit of a dead room in front of you, essentially.
But, didn't make a lot of difference.
No, it might make a little bit of difference with a different mic, but the mics we've got here are very quite localized, and yes, absolutely, Australian-built, gorgeous mics,
anyway.
Rode Procasters.
So it's just, it is a bit dangerous buy stuff and...
Yeah.
But having said that, I'm going to use it to dampen down the sound of the switcher in the room. So
I mean, I would suggest if you actually want to have produce enhanced depth, you know, maybe how about a bit of, you know...
Some good lenses?
Shoot with a slightly larger sensor or, you know, go wide open or start working wide open with these lenses. I know it's quite hard if you're in the middle of a TV studio. It's a bit hard to sort of start whipping out ND filters. But, look, you know, depth is...
Well, let's switch our attention then to talk about that is pretty interesting, which is the Phantom HD. So, I was lucky enough, as you were, to go to a night put on by some guys at Panavision who have got three of these in our region. And this is the Phantom HD, and I thought it was worth having a chat about it because I thought last night's presentation was really good. I shot with the Phantom HD, though I shot with V10, And this is a significantly improved version. It looks exactly the same, but the guts have all been ripped out and been replaced with the new version.
So this is the Phantom HD that we were seeing mm-hmm. last night. Yeah.
Yeah, but even the Phantom HD, there was a V10 version, which right. basically got replaced. And what changed, I'm kind of jumping ahead, but what changed between the V10 version and this version is the like the kind of internals, which meant that there were problems that we were seeing in terms of chromatic aberration and stuff about 18 months ago when it first came out that have been fixed. But the Phantom camera, for those of you that don't know, is basically a digital camera. It's a CMOS chip. It's a big chip. It's like 25.6 millimeters square that shoots basically high speed. And it shoots high speed beyond what Red is capable of. So in a sensible kind of workflow, you can come up with all sorts of weird and wonderful versions of this. But in a sensible workflow, you can shoot up to like 1,000 frames a second at HD. If you drop down to 720, that goes up to about 1,500. If you drop down to standard def, we're now up at about 2,000, 2,400. And you could actually go further than that, but you'd be below 780 vertical lines resolution. So you would want to be a component of something that you were using. Now, let's put that in context. Obviously, Red's going up to about 100 frames a second. If you want to slow a bullet down and see a bullet literally going across frame and going through an apple, you need to be up at about 10,000 frames a second. But at 2,000 frames a second or 1,000 frames a second, you're at the level that you can see. The classic one is like a balloon full of water. If you pierce the balloon, you can actually watch the rubber peeling back around from the surface tension of the rubber and leaving a giant ball of water in the air, which then starts to break apart as it falls down. And quite frankly, if I want to shoot a balloon full of water, this would be the camera that I'd go for. But it's replacing those sort of high-speed film cameras, a lot of which were sort of ex-military, you know, high-speed Mitchells and stuff.
Yeah, photosonics
like,
and that sort of stuff.
500 frames a second kind of stuff. Yeah. And so there are some really good, I guess, uses for it in slow-mo advertising kind of shots.
One of the absolute killers at Cannes Advertising Festival this year was an Australian ad for Schweppes, which is essentially a whole lot of bursting balloons, talking about, you know, bubbles, obviously, and there was a very subtle commercial. But YouTube, you know, you search for Schweppes balloon ad and you're going to see plenty of it. It's beautifully. Yeah, absolutely. I think it, you know, did really well, like getting gold, getting metal at least. And, that was done about 1,000 frames a second, and that was a shot here in Australia, and did really, really well. And that's an excellent example of what 1,000 frames a second will get you.
Now, I was talking to someone about that, and it may have been you, so I apologize if it was, but I was talking about how they actually burst the balloons. Was that you that I was talking about?
No, I'm not sure, but I have heard a little bit about how they did it.
If you're watching the Schweppes spot, there are these balloons kind of falling, obviously, in slow-mo, and then they pop. And they did all sorts of really cool things, like putting acupuncture needles strapped inside the hands of actors so that they could, you know, trigger the popping and stuff. And obviously had to have green screen and removal of some wires and rigs to show stuff going. But, yeah, like it is really good. But I guess the thing is, once you've done balloons popping, my question is, can you see you using it? Because, I mean, once that's done, that's a look.
Well, the trick of it is that, obviously, I mean, what we were seeing last night was shots that were done at 1,000 frames a second. And you get, at that speed, you get like a little 4-second burst to shoot at. And once you've shot it, that 4-second shot ends up with like 3 minutes of footage, which obviously the trick is, and they've succeeded with Schweppes, but the trick is just fitting the shots into anything. I don't care whether it's feature, whether you've got a 30-second commercial or, you know, a whole scene out of a feature or a doco. It's not easy to get these shots in there. So it's definitely have to have quite specific needs for this footage, because, you know, slow-mo can get slow-mo pretty quick. Anyone who's even shot stuff at 100 frames a second know that things can get slow pretty quick. Even on set, if I'm just wanting to just take the edge off something on set and just shoot something and say it at 30 frames a second, even at 30 frames a second, you can sometimes wish, gee, I wish I'd thought it shot at 28, or, you know, you shoot it at 50 and you very quickly go, damn, why didn't we do a 36 frame a second version? Things can get quite quick, quite slow, quite easily, and obviously editors go nuts with this stuff, trying to, you need every shot, you know, need like an in point and an out point essentially. And yeah, if you've got a bursting balloon that's taking 10 seconds to see the skin of the balloon slowly travel all the way around and the waterfall pretty hard to get the scissors in there. So, you know, I mean, it's utterly beautiful. I mean, you can build an entire commercial with one shot, and it's just something inherently fascinating about slow-mo when you go deep, deep slow-mo. That
we were on a campaign for SBS that was shot a lot of macro high-speed, which did produce, you know, some amazing results. The most obvious one, of course, is the drop of water, but... you know, other things that were like that, that were pretty darn interesting. Let's just explain how it works for people that haven't used it. So the camera itself can be completely self-contained, and you can stick a different mount on the front of it because it'll take a PL mount lens, but it'll also take PV if you change the mount. And that means you can then, you know, put rods on it and put a matte box on it, and it'll look like a camera. The actual camera itself, though, is pretty small and doesn't look like a normal camera in the sense it doesn't have many buttons on it. It certainly doesn't have things like, I don't know, viewfinders and LCDs and stuff. You have to kind of bolt all of that sort of stuff on. And the reason for all of this is it's basically a scientific camera that's been modified for use in the film industry.
Yeah, it's like crash testing and any scientific motion analysis camera, really. And it's been shoehorned by Vision Research into the film world.
Now, Vision Research...
And pretty successfully.
Vision Research produced cameras that shoot much, much higher frame rates than even this, and yet have a really, really small set of pixels. So, for example, I was talking to Vision Research about the fact that they shoot to determine the decay of a flash. So if you think about that for a second...
The decay of a flash.
The decay of a flash.
Okay.
But at that point, you're no longer worried about a lot of spatial resolution left and right. You could literally have like a small patch of 30 pixels by 30 pixels.
Yeah.
As long as you're shooting at like, you know, basically 100,000 frames a second kind of thing, you're going to see the rise and fall of the light levels that are caused by the flash and get a really good view. So they are specialists in this kind of stuff. The shutter speed on this camera alone can go to 0.5 millionth of a second. So if you think about that for a second, these numbers are all way out beyond what Red can do. Yeah. And one of the reasons I thought it was worth discussing this camera is that when Red showed the specs on Epic and Skull, there was a bit of a discussion about the fact that it didn't go to slower slow-mo. And quite a few people were expecting that maybe they would go up to 1,000 frames a second. The camera's shooting raw, and the way that it works physically is that there's a DRAM on board, and that DRAM is not like a CF card. This is volatile memory. If you pull the plug, you'll lose it. But that DRAM, say, is 16 gig, depending on how you configure the camera. And as Jay said, it would give you about 4.44 seconds worth of recording at 100 frames a second, kind of HD 1920 by 1080. So what that means is you get 4,385 frames. Now, to get those frames and to record them, you can set up a trigger mode where it's actually in constant loop. So it's feeding information in from the sensor into that RAM, and it's a traveling cache. So what is happening is that any point that you, once you've set it up, any time that you hit the trigger, it can say, oh, well, why don't I give you the last 2 seconds before you press the button and another 2 seconds after this, so that if you have literally an explosion or something, when the explosion goes off, you press the button, your reaction times are what, like half a second?
Yeah.
Maybe?
So you can set it to, if within those 4 seconds you've got to play with, you can set it to pre-record 1 second before you press the button and keep recording the 3 seconds after, or 2 seconds before you press the button, 2 seconds after. But it's brilliant. It is a brilliant way to go. It just means that... you know, you never really miss the shot. So,
but that 4.4 seconds turns into 3 minutes, as Jay said. Now, the thing about it is that's all being held in our 16 gig of DRAM. We can then copy that up to the Cinemag, and a Cinemag is a 512 gigabyte sort of clip-on hard drive, effectively, which we're kind of used to in Red World, and that would hold 90 minutes at 1920 by 1080. Now, I should point out that 4.4 seconds has turned into 3 minutes when we put it up to the Cinemag. If you're shooting lower frame rates, like something under about 300, 350 frames a second, you can actually just shoot straight to that mag, and there'd be nothing wrong doing that. I mean, you could literally set up a camera shoot of, I don't know, cars or something, and you could hit the button, and if it was recording around the 300 frames a second mark, it would just happily plow that up to the Cinemag, and you just happily record it until you ran out of time.
Yeah.
But let's assume that we're not doing that.
One of the interesting theories with it is that it obviously, it holds that 4 second burst, but that's all the camera holds. So once you've shot that take, then you make the decision to either ditch that from the RAM or bump it up to the DMAG, or you can actually choose just a little bit. If you've got 3 minutes of footage, you can actually whip through it and say, that's my in point, that's my out point. Just send that particular part of the data up to the DMAG and trash the rest. But basically, to do another take, to do a take two, you've got to clear your RAM. And so one of the other things they were suggesting that was very important with that is that to operate not on battery, because it gives you no low battery warning at all, is to operate off mains and off a UPS, so that if someone pulls the pin on you, you don't lose that shot. Until you've bumped it up into the DMAG, the shot's just sitting there in RAM on the camera, and it's just as volatile as you know what you're working on your computer before, you know, the power pop, the power cut happens, yeah. You know, you lose everything. So it's
I said about 300 frames, but actually it's 450 frames that you can run. You can run at 450 frames a second to the Cinemag. Otherwise, you have to go to the DMAG, and the Cinemag isn't volatile. The only thing is, though, right. Jason, I was kind of surprised about this. There are a couple of things I was surprised about. Three, I think. First one was that the time to download that 512 gig hard drive is 8 to 10 hours.
Yeah, there's a lot of posts, so you really need to sort of pre-work that out on your shoot. And be very frugal, as I was saying. The camera does give you that option to send just the beauty part of the shot to the mag to sort of conserve.
Trim
your shots exactly to conserve how much you actually of the proper data you want to keep, just so that you're limiting how much downtime you've got, because as you say, this is raw. It's not just going to be the bumping it off to another RAID drive, but it's going to be the rendering it out at the other end. You don't want to have tons and tons of footage to work through, as you say, 8 or 10 hours. They're saying for a full that's just physically going through eSATA, just literally copying the mag off onto whatever you want
it's
to take
kind of
it away
fun.
With.
It shows you how kind of spoilt we are in Red World, where we sort of just take it for granted almost that. That we can get stuff out.
Well, this is because it's fairly uncompressed. The other thing, I mean, you've got your list of that you're impressed. The other thing I was impressed with is that it's essentially a 35mm sensor. The footage I was seeing last night was looking fantastic. It just looked like film to me. And from someone who's grown up, you know, loading and having anything above 100 frames a second, you have to pull out a camera the size of a house and you'll rip through 1,000 feet in no seconds flat. And, you know, a film jam is a two-hour clean-out job, and after every take you've got to get 3 syringes of 4 different oils and lubricate 18 different parts of the camera just to be able to go and do a take two. And, you know, there's no kind of buffer system there. If you go and action and the rig fails or the guy doesn't drop the boiled egg into the boiling water at the right time, there goes 1,000 feet of film, there goes $1,500. It's to see this very filmic-looking imagery up to, you know, 3 times what you used to be able to do in 35mm film. It's just outstanding. The camera rental alone would be paid for in 3 takes worth of film the old way. So this is just genius. So, yeah, it's essentially, obviously, the amount
worth about $150,000, so it's not a cheap camera. But
No, but in terms of rental, it was, you know, pretty. I think they're sort of saying in terms of Australian dollars, $3,000 to $5,000 or so for a day, which is, you know, easily paid for in film costs the other way around. It looked very filmic, didn't
just,
it?
Just I thought was a classic illustration of why light is not linear, it's logarithmic, is that if you think about it, like obviously 25 frames a second into 1,000 frames a second is like a 40 times piece of maths.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting is that's if you go 25, double it to 50.
Exactly.
Double it to 100, double it to 2, to 4, to 8,
you gotta
up
keep
to 1,600. You're at about 5.5 stops of light that you lose.
Yeah.
Assuming also that we take into account that you could decide to shoot open shutter with 360 or 180, but of course you and I are addicts for 180-degree shutter.
Absolutely, but that
light becomes an issue.
That was a very interesting exercise last night, was that what they were doing to get in their test, real world testing. If you were just going straight by the math and going by the old film rules, you'd say no, put it on 180 degree shutter, because you can obviously set this camera anyway from down to nothing, 1 degree, all the way up to 360 degrees, essentially switching the electronic shutter off. Now, what was unusual was a lot of the stuff we saw last night was done at 360 frames a 360 degree shutter essentially, and it looked On the whole, mostly it looked like film.
I think that was partly the nature of the beast. Like, if things are moving that slowly, you almost can't tell motion blur either way.
That's why it was you were getting away with it, because the imagery in the part of the beauty of it is that everything, no matter if you're doing popping balloons or skidding tires or, you know, falling water, it was all moving through the frame so incredibly slowly. You didn't get the chance to see that motion blur. It was only when things moved quite quickly through the frame, if you were following something moving quite rapidly, even at 1,000 frames a second, then you started to see it, and obviously going to 180 made more sense. But yeah, when you're talking losing five stops of light just to get to 1,000 frames a second or whatever, it's definitely, if you can get that extra stop and get away with it by opening the shutter to 360, then it's you know, definitely well worth it. But again, I mean, the good thing with all of it, light flicker, are you seeing blur? Are you not? You get to see it, you know, right away. There's no gotchas. And I'm sorry to be sort of shitting on film with this, but, you know, having been there, so many gotchas at the end of the day of thousands and thousands of feet of film, and it's only the next day that you get to see, oh, right, that...
It's pretty noisy too.
That light in the background is flickering, or, gee, we're getting a lot of motion blur, or, gee, you know, there's... yeah, all those gotchas are sort of gone out the window.
That was one of the things we were discussing about flicker. Like, with the lights, obviously normally if you were shooting... Well, let me before I even get to that, let me flag the second thing I found surprising, which is the sensor's sweet spot is actually at tungsten color temperature and not at daylight color temperature. And that they were rating it at 320 last night. Now, actually, I know that they normally rate it at 500 or plus, and I was asking them about that, and they're rating it down at 320 because the reason is that is they lower the rating. Basically, they're lifting the image up above the noise floor, and so to get, because there is quite a jump on the sensor for, like, it's a 14-bit sensor, but still, as we've discussed in the past with the Red camera, for example, there's the inherent camera RGB native gamut, and then there's the Rec 709 or whatever color space that you're going to, and the leap from the inner tighter natural color space that the camera has out to the more expansive defined video world of, say, Rec 709 is a source of noise. And on the Red, we know that's like somewhere between 6 and 9 dB. Now, that's perfectly normal in every camera from Genesis right through, though in this camera it's quite a jump. And so to get nice clean images that aren't very noisy, they're actually rating it down a whole stop. So instead of shooting it with maybe at 500, where you'd go, you know, a kind of even split of latitude above and below it, they're actually rating it lower at 320, and that would give you a split that would give you a less noisy signal. And it didn't look noisy, did it? It looked
not
good.
At
320, I think it was good. I would definitely be shooting this camera at 320.
Admittedly, but it's also no grain whatsoever, but, you know, you can always put that in later. But, yeah, no, it's extremely clean.
Which brings me to the lighting thing. Because tungsten's its natural sweet spot in terms of color temperature, the normal thing you do is you go, well, let's use flicker-free ballast, right?
Yeah.
But the guys were actually discussing that that isn't quite that simple. Like, a flicker-free with a dimmer is still going to cause problems.
Because flicker-free essentially is another name for actually high-speed ballast, as far as if I've got my vague director's tech right, is that it doesn't actually have no flicker. A lot of the flicker-free lights are just so high, so fast a hertz, that it's not, in terms of what film can capture, it's considered...
Not a problem.
...considered flicker-free. But once you start to get up to 1,000 frames a second, you are definitely starting to see way beyond pulses of flicker-free lighting, and almost to the point of that they were suggesting that you almost have to go... Even with DC light, even with not DC lights, but even with tungsten lights, which essentially, obviously, we know don't have a flicker. If you're using them like quite dimmed down, or if you're using them at quite low wattage, you will actually start to see a flicker on a tungsten light. Tungsten light will start to flicker because you actually start to see the element physically cooling down and heating up with the frequency of your power source.
It's
AC power, and even I've definitely seen this. I've seen this on film with if you've got little low wattage bulbs and you're running 100 frames a second or something. I have seen a pulse on you know, little lights, little peanut lights or peanut bulbs.
One of the DOPs from, because there were some amazing DOPs there last night. Peter James was there, wasn't he, from who you spotted. DOP did Driving Miss Daisy. But one of the guys from DOP's from King Kong was there. He was discussing that they'd come up with an elaborate rig to get around Flickr on their thing. But I was asking after the event to one of the guys whether LCD would flicker, because I just didn't know. And he said that actually...
LED,
I'm sorry, what did I say?
Yeah, LCD.
I'm sorry. LED, yeah, because I think LED is a really interesting lighting technology. I think it's getting a lot of traction right now because it's also a green kind of lighting thing, and a lot of film crews are quite sensitive about the carbon footprint of a film production, and so I personally like them as well. And, yeah, so they were thought to be actually pretty good. Again, if they're on dimmers, there can be some issues.
Yeah, but the dimmer, again, if your light doesn't have a flicker, or if you've got an LED that's not flickering at all, if you put it through a dimmer, the dimmer essentially, the modern dimmers are not this big, you know, wound coil old big rheostat of days gone past. The modern dimmers are what they call switch mode, which is essentially doing the same thing. It's actually chopping the frequency. It is actually adding a frequency into the light. So all these high-speed photography, they're saying keep the dimmers in the truck, leave it alone, because you may have a flicker-free light, but as soon as you dim it, you're actually putting flicker.
Yeah, like let's say you put up a bunch of LED panels and you want to adjust the light. Well, you need to walk the lights in and out. Like you physically, you know, use inverse square law of distance to get a lighting change. And that's exactly. Pretty interesting.
But it was, yeah, they're definitely, we're thinking even to what you, the amount of stops you're trying to get, you're actually, and the fact that you want to have no flicker, they're suggesting for some of this stuff that you should actually use, I'm trying to think what it's called, the Arisun, Soft Sun, which is essentially, which is like 100 kilowatt.
Oh, it's like
something like that. I'm sorry, I'm speaking
the big one we shot with, the huge one.
Yeah, well, I had one on set. I had one on set 2 weeks ago, and it would not strike. It would not start. And they basically had said, sorry, it's the bulb. And that was a $5,000 bulb going, you know, in the trash because it just wouldn't fire. So this is a...
It's like an arc, right?
Scary light. It's brighter than... They say it's brighter than the sun.
It is like put sunglasses on. Yeah, I mean, you actually physically have health and safety to warn the crew to not be looking in the direction when you switch it on.
Eventually, when we got another bulb in later on, we essentially had a day that the sun was going in and out. And we had one of these there as backups. And when you put that on, I was like, I couldn't even go up to actors and talk to them because I was like glaring. I really felt like I was actually, you know, you get that, get to the end of the day and you feel like you've got sunstroke. I honestly did feel that way, and definitely was could feel like, you know, I had to go and get some, put some sunscreen on. It's
on Superman Returns, they had two of those, one above the other, to get the depth of field on the Genesis. And because the Genesis couldn't open up to do long exposure like you can with, say, a film camera, or even to that matter, Red can do now. A second exposure. So there, to pump up the number of light to get the depth of field. Because last night we were still at, 2.8 on the lens?
Yeah, still wide open. As soon as they went to 180-degree shutter, it took a whole... It went down quite... took a big whack out of it and everything got dark and they had to start bumping in lights just to go from 360 to 180. So, So it definitely requires some kilowatts and a lot of... You'll see a lot of... When you look at the Schweppes, spot. Actually, a lot of it you'll see that the actual ambient light is quite dark, and the hottest part of the shot is there's a lot of backlight on it. I'm imagining they're putting it soft sun and a lot of lights on this thing to even if you're outdoors to get to 1,000 frames a second. Interestingly, if you go to a resolution of 16:8, 16 pixels by 8 pixels, you can do 111,000 frames a second,
which is the sort of level you need to be at to do strobe decays and flashes.
You've got the math brain. You could probably tell me how many stops lost from 25 frames that is, but it's a crap load.
Just keep doubling it, dude. Hey, the other thing that we were interested, these guys are obviously Panavision, great company, very practical, discussing Spartacus, which is currently shooting in New Zealand with the camera. Now, that's a Genesis primarily shoot, but they have a Phantom that they're shooting. And I do not know the story of this, but obviously anything called Spartacus, you expect it to be a bit of a sandal and sand kind of epic.
I think it's ultra slow-mo decapitations and arms being cut off with swords.
Right. But and trust me, I would love to speak to anyone working on Spartacus in New Zealand. It would be great to get some first-hand information. But what I thought was interesting there is that they were actually going 360-degree open shutter because when somebody's moving very slowly through screen, and that was a point I think even Peter James May, these, when you shoot like any humans at above 500 frames, they don't do much.
No, absolutely.
And you get that. You get some nice shots of like muscles rippling, like especially if you've got a runner or an athlete, you get some really interesting muscle definition stuff happening with the human body that you don't read, I believe.
That's like right.
Athletes or gymnasts at 500 plus is just gorgeous to
That's
watch.
The beauty of slow-mo is that you start to not see the overall motion if you're talking about somebody sprinting full sprint at you down a racetrack, down a running track to the lens. You don't really get to see the necessarily how the guy's running gait is happening. You're so slow. You're starting, as you say, you're starting to see when the foot hits the ground, you start to see all the shockwave going through the leg and the, you know, all these micro little movements start to open up and you get to start to really notice the little tiniest little inflection. It is a fantastic example of less is more, isn't it?
Yeah, and look, this chip is a really interesting chip. It is a very powerful CMOS chip. It's producing 14-bit sensor data, so 42-bit color. The thing is that while it is like a 12.5 micron CMOS chip and stuff and can do, is hence got rolling shutter and all that kind of stuff, what I found most interesting about it, coming from a scientific imaging background, it has a gotcha, if you like, that the black balance needs to be done probably every 5 to 10 minutes. And that's an unexpected thing, and I've seen what happens when you don't black balance and you get this kind of vertical streaking or irregularity in the vertical consistency.
I don't get it.
So if you are renting this camera to do a specialist job, we're not making this up, every 5 minutes, pretty much between every take almost, you'd be wanting to redo the black balance. And
and they're just saying, you know, if you're prepared for it, I mean, the good, you've got to take the good with the bad. You're not reloading film every 5 minutes. I don't know how actually long the process takes.
Oh, it's very fast, but you still have to, of course, black out the lens.
And what they're saying is they're just, you know, essentially be prepared and you use a matte box with a top flap on it and you just, you know, it's fine. You just flip the flap down over the matte box, do what you've got to do and then take the matte box. You know, you don't have to.
It has to completely cover it though, right?
Yeah, yeah. If you've got a matte box with a mat on the front of it, with the matte square mat on it, and then put the flip the mat top flap down, do your black balance, and then lift it up again. So if you're prepared for it, it's fine, and everyone knows to be expected. But it doesn't sound like it takes forever. It sounds like it's way quicker than, you know, reloading a mag.
And you're going to want to have probably a Phantom Tech running it for you. So
definitely,
in terms of camera op, they're going to have a laptop like a Mac or a PC that's connected up, that's actually driving the camera and controlling it, and also managing the data transfers up to the more secure memory. And
yeah,
so
because you can run tethered or not tethered, as far as I know. If you want, you really want it, you can do it all with the three buttons, which is obviously a bit clunky, but you can essentially just plug the thing in and run as is, just with the viewfinder.
But if you were doing, like, let's say you were shooting, right? Let's say you had a really cool car commercial and you had 4 days of shooting normal and then one day of super high speed stuff.
Yeah.
You'd bring out a tech with that camera that day.
Definitely. You don't want to, this was some pretty deep stuff and you don't want to screw it up. Just the same as, you know, if you haven't worked with Red before, you should get, you know, definitely get a DIT that knows what they're
doing.
But
you're going to get spectacular results and something
beautiful.
That's quite... The only thing I would say, optically speaking, I think that it does look very cinematic, and I do think that the bokeh and the whole fact that you can use 35 lenses is terrific. For me, I notice the fact that when it hits the clip, it hits it really hard. There's almost no shoulder going into the whites, and I think Red has done a great job with doing that, and it's only when you see something like this Phantom HD, which is a terrific camera, but it's just so slams the wall when it hits full white, that I notice how well Red has done in rolling that off the top. Now, the difference between the version 10 and the current version is quite significant, because we've discussed this in the past, the idea of having an anti-aliasing filter in the camera and how that effectively reduces the absolute resolution in terms of weird measuring stuff. Not that you care, but there are artifacts that you do not see in Red because there's a big anti-aliasing process that happens from the sensor of the CMOS. That wasn't there in the initial release of the Phantom HD, and so the current Phantom HD and any one that's been pretty in the last, you know what, 12 months is going to have that in it. But you actually want that really badly, because I've seen chromatic aberrations and stuff that were really quite ugly way out when they first came out in Los Angeles, when we were doing some work there in LA, and I didn't like it a lot then. I liked it a lot more now, but it's still quite an abrupt hit to the white point. But having said that, I mean, it's a look, right? It's a very, very specific, cool look.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the right spot.
I mean, mainly I wanted to go there as a director to see, you know, how much of a pain in the ass is this thing to work with and what are the actual images look like. And I was really, really impressed. It looked like really, you know, if you've got the right tech with you, it's should be no more clunky with working with anything else, any other sort of camera. And yeah, I was really impressed with the images looking very filmy. I'm just rapt that it's actually got a full 35 sensor. You know, you're not, it's not a weird 2/3-inch thing, and it's not this incredible scientific, like working with motion control and have to have 5 techs and you do 3 shots and you lose 2 of them. No, I was, you know, really impressed that it can fit quite into a set pretty easily without being a lot of gotchas.
Yeah, one other thing that's just a kind of peculiarity of how it works is when we're talking about the what you're getting out of it, like you're getting out 2048 by 2048, or literally 2K squared. As you reduce the resolution, what you do actually do is you reduce the vertical resolution by throwing away like blacking, like you put a crop on it or a black mask. So as you get down to 720, what you don't get is a postage stamp in the middle. You actually get this horizontal wide but 720 high or 408 or whatever it is, high image. And so what's really funny about that is that when you're looking at it on the screen, you've got this like big scope, wide-angle picture.
Yeah, wider than Panavision.
Wider than Panavision. But in fact, that's just because it doesn't save anything by shutting down pixels left and right of where you want to be. Mm. It saves information by not having the whole line. So it turns the line off at a time. And so as you start getting to these lower, faster frame rates, what you end up with is a very, very horizontal, boxy, rectangular kind of image. And if you haven't seen it before, it's a little unusual. But again, it just reflects the fact this camera comes from a scientific background where they're trying to be very accurate and do what they can do. And we've lucky that they've decided to try and make a sort of film version of it to allow the film industry to access this stuff.
So the plus for that is that obviously all of that left and right is usable. If you've got, as you say, if you're doing shooting 720p, you've almost got 2 or 3 frame widths of 720p's to pan and scan or to be able to crop in later on. So if you've got something falling through frame or an arrow going left to right or something
Turn the camera on
you
its
can
side.
Actually you what could you well yeah you could turn the camera on its side, or essentially you have the ability to pan and scan your obviously in post to be able to select which part of that really wide image you want to use. So yeah, you do get a little bit of a bonus there. There's no racking top and bottom, but you do have this ability to explore a whole left and right frame.
There's so like 16:9 guides or
yeah. So what it could actually let you do, I suppose, is do a bit of a pan, make it look like you've had the incredible super
slow-mo,
super bionic ability to tilt with a falling image or pan with something rolling along the floor or whatever.
That'd be cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so you could actually do the rack in post, I guess, which is make you look like you've panned something. I've tried to even it's 100 frames a second trying to pan with someone jumping out of a chair, or it's, you know, it's a world of hurt. So that
because it's shooting raw, you really have to have the Iridis software to be able to deal with it to make it look good. But when you do process it that way, it does look pretty good in post. And there is some serious processing time to do it because they're shooting literally raw files. And the raw files themselves look kind of dark, as you'd expect. And then once you run it through in Iridis, you get a nice-looking thing.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Generally, I just would say I really enjoyed last night. I thought it was good. Great group of DOPs.
Yes, thanks to Panavision and Don Virtue.
I did not want to be the guy operating when that many DOPs are sitting outside, because there was one point where there was a bit of, you know how there always is, like you're just mucking around with the menus and there's a bit of finger trouble, and a take was done that wasn't recorded, and there was like 30 DOPs going. I think we should shoot the recording and shoot the rehearsal and just, oh my god,
and they're all mic'd in there so you can hear everyone. What do we do now? You just go, I'll go 1, 2, 3 and you
it's just like I've done flame demos to flame community. And like, if you can't find a button at the second that you need to find it, someone will yell out, "It's on the left." Thank you for mentioning. Well, for a show that was going to be very short, we've actually run long again. So
we've got a half an hour interview
and
now.
We're going to go to the interview now. So I apologize about that, guys. We'll try and it'll be shorter than last week, but I'm afraid we're still going to hit 1:20.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the interview now and get off this Phantom discussion.
Yeah. So this is not Red related. But I just thought it was an interesting story.
But it's digital.
Yes, it's essentially shot Vericam. But it was some quite interesting technical issues, which he outlines about what camera the choice, what was the right choice of camera. And they actually did a bit of a pre-recce to work out, you know, what should we go with? Should we go with film? And there was a lot of issues with shooting on the deck, with radar, electromagnetic pulses from radar, and how to work a way around that. And, you know, bringing a lot more gear than you needed to just to cover yourself because you're on board for months.
10 sort of Navy captains and admirals or whoever in the suite with you reviewing footage.
Oh, now that's some pressure. Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah.
These guys are hardcore. Because, I mean, you know, the men and women of the military are like, they have a very serious profession.
And they had very little time to sort of know when they were going to launch. Obviously, when the ship was going to go was a bit of a secret because this we're talking, although it's only just screened here in Australia in 09, it was on air, and I think in the States in 08, but this was all shot in 2005.
It's on DVD, right?
It's on DVD. I've had to get it in from the States. Hopefully, it'll come to DVD here. Has been on Foxtel here in Australia. But if there is, if you can go to PBS's website, and if you use the sort of some of the IP address cloaking bits of software to mask which country you're surfing from, you can actually play the clips essentially on PBS's website. If you're in the right region, you can watch the entire all 10 eps. I recommend obviously not getting it on, catching it on TV or getting the DVD. But you can watch it all on PBS's website, and I've put links to that in the show notes, of course, as always. It was definitely a really interesting technical discussion, and thank you to Axel for taking the time. Here he is. Well, thanks, Axel, for taking the time to chat. I'm really happy to speak to you.
You're welcome. I'm glad. Thank you for asking me.
Well, look, let's start briefly with the Axel Bauman story.
Sure. Basically, I started out as a camera PA in New York. I worked on a feature called Johnny Suede in, I think, 1989 with actually Brad Pitt in one of his first roles. Wow. And I was a PA. It was a Panavision job. I was taught to load mags and fill out camera reports. And then I became a camera assistant. In 95, I joined a union. I worked on commercials and television shows. And in 97, I bought an Aton, an XDR Plus, and I started shooting low-budget features and music videos and things like that, all pretty much out of New York. And then in 99, I did a job for National Geographic on, it was the first job that Geographic originating on HD. It was a 10-part series on world music.
Sounds fantastic.
And and from there, I kind of got a little bit more and more into documentaries, you know, shot for Discovery, Geographic, and different people like that. So I've kind of, you know, I've shot a lot of film, but I've also done the doc thing as well. So
fantastic. I understand Carrier was a while ago now, but just give us an overview of that project and how you came to it.
We went out in May of 2005, and I literally got the call 2 weeks before the ship was to leave. Now, a lot of times in documentaries, there's a little bit of a leeway if things get pushed and this and that. But in this case, because we were getting on an aircraft carrier, a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier, which was going on a real deployment to the Persian Gulf, there was no change of date. You know, we were leaving on that date. So it was somewhere in May, 4th of May of 2005 or something like that. And I think I got the call literally 10 days before that. And they said, it's a 6-month project. We're going on May 4th and we're coming back in November. There might be a break in the middle. We're not quite sure because we don't exactly know when we're getting off the ship and when, you know, because we were literally, tied to the Navy schedule when they were pulling into ports and this and that. So it was all a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, that's not a lot of time to get your life together for 6 months away.
Yeah, and, you know, somehow it just worked for me. It was kind of the right time for a project like that. I'm not sure if it always will be the right time for something like that, but it was the right time. I didn't really have anything long-term coming up. I wasn't in a relationship, so I really was kind of ready to go on something like that. And I was excited to have a project that, you know, had multiple series parts, multiple characters, was visually would be visually exciting. So it all kind of clicked and worked really well for me.
Well,
obviously you weren't alone. There was a whole bunch of other people along with you. Take us through who went with you and what your crew consisted of.
Well, they decided to have three camera teams. It was myself, Alex Dietrich, Alex Stieglitz. After a month, two of those fellas left, and then the people that came on were Bob Hanna and Mark Bryce, and the three of us did the entire remaining part of the trip. And then with about 2 months left, 2.5 months left, Wolfgang Held joined us, and Uli Bonekamp came with about 6 weeks, 2 months left. And those are the guys that we shared the Emmy with. The five of us got the Emmy.
And obviously you had production people, and I believe you had an editor on board as well.
Yeah, what we did is we had, first they wanted to make clones. Obviously, you don't send the originals overseas. So we were cloning every tape. Then we had to make a captain's reel. The agreement with production was that the captain would get a half hour to 45 minute reel once a week, which I think turned into a 1 hour reel once every 2 weeks. But essentially, an editor was on board. He was cloning tapes. And he was making these kind of reels, which consisted of interviews and some B-roll.
Probably would have been quite informative for him, actually. There's probably a lot of stuff about his ship that he didn't know about, or a lot about what people on his ship were thinking that he didn't know about.
Right, which was kind of a bit of a political game between, you know, production and the Navy, because the truth is that we didn't want to get anybody in trouble, and you know, we wanted people to feel free to say whatever they wanted to say on camera, and we didn't want to hand something to the captain and then the captain or his people would then reprimand these sailors. So, you know, there was a bit of a cat and mouse game going on, in which we had scenes that we didn't show them, you know. But, you know, at the end, they saw everything. So it was just really while we were doing this that here or there, there were some scenes, you know, where people used profanity or they kind of said things about the ship or the captain. We were like, you know, maybe that's not the best thing, but...
So what gear did you take with you in terms of cameras? You mentioned tapes, but you also took film with you as well.
Right. I think 3 months before we got on the ship, there was a team of people. I don't remember who the camera people, two, like a cameraman and an assistant and a producer, who went out and they shot tests. And they shot with an SDX 900, standard def. They shot with a Varicam. They shot with an F900, and they shot even mini DV, DVX100. They shot with an Aton, a Super 16, and a DigiBater, because they weren't sure, you know, they were trying to figure out, should we really go HD? There was a question, might go standard def with an SDX and so forth. But they wanted to see, obviously, the look of it and then compare it to the pricing and what, you know, is it worth it to them to shoot on HD?
Yeah, great idea to do that.
Yeah.
Because they learned a lot anyway.
They learned a lot. And also, the thing that was nice is there was a big budget on this. I think the budget was $10 million. And so, you know, you're going overseas. You're not coming back. Once we were on the ship, we were not coming back. So it's not like we could have shot for 2 weeks and then decided, oh, you know what? It's a long project. We're not really happy with the format we're shooting. Let's change something. You know, that was not going to happen. So it really had to be decided before we left and so forth. So they decided to shoot with a Varicam. We shot with three Varicams. We shot 24p. We shot film record mode. We shot, I think, a dynamic level of 400. You know, we shot a master gamma of 45.45. And each team had the Canon 11x4.7 wide angle zoom and a Canon 21x7.5 long lens. You know, they wanted a little bit, just to talk a little bit about the look, they wanted a little bit of a flat look. I mean, at first we wanted 24p because there's not just a 10-part series, there's also a 90-minute feature. So they, you know, they knew where they were going to make a film out. The film has not been distributed, so that ended up not happening. However, they wanted to shoot 24p. To get a more filmic look and for the film out.
Well, he succeeded. It looks fantastic. I really couldn't pick it all the way through. It was only the production shots online that sort of gave it away that it was Varicam, because I presumed going on board with, you know, industrial hazardous areas, climbing up rigging to get shots, filming out of the back of aircraft, I thought, you know, you've got to go film to do this. But, I mean, you did have it with you, but it sounds like you didn't use it.
Yeah, the reason we took the film cameras, because when they did the test, they immediately realized when you shoot on the deck of an aircraft carrier, there's so much radar going on that the radar was hitting, it was giving us video hits. And the hits are incredibly noticeable. You notice them immediately, so there's no way around it. So they decided, oh, okay, well, I guess we'll shoot film. We'll shoot with a film camera on deck. They went out and bought 250 rolls of film. I have an Aton. I brought my Aton with me, and the idea was to shoot on film up there. When we were on the ship, we started to play with things like aluminum foil. You know, we started to wrap the video cameras with all kinds of different material. We went to the Navy. They gave us some kind of radar-proof material. We wrapped it with that. And eventually what we did is we found this material. We triple-layered it. We sent it to Port-au-Prince. And they made these very, you know, handy kind of vests for the camera. You could put the audio guys could put their little, transmitters in the back and so forth. And then we just abandoned the film thing, stopped shooting film after like 15, 20 rolls, and just shot with a Varicam on deck, which was incredibly useful because I don't think could have shot so many intimate scenes if we had stayed on film. And the other thing is that there were three teams, so each one of us had a set of characters that we were following. And, you know, if we had to share this kind of film camera, you know, around three camera men, each time they wanted to go up and shoot one of their scenes, it just would have been chaotic. And sometimes there were two of us who were shooting on the deck, or three of us. So it just wouldn't have worked the way it worked.
So why do you think you would have got more intimate stuff going the way you would rather than going film?
Well, because, you know, on a flight deck, to shoot on a flight, it's a live flight deck. There are planes around you that are moving, that are blasting hot air, out of the outtake of their jets.
It looks like a lethal place to be.
Yeah. You know, and we were in cranials, we were wearing all kinds of gear, you know, so basically it's hard to change anything. It's hard to change a mag up there and have somebody run off and go load a mag somewhere and then come back and find you. Will you be in the same spot? It's hard to get back to the same spot. You know, even if you have two or three mags, to change a mag up there is not simple. So to change a tape is much, kind of quicker, and it, just the whole workflow just wouldn't have worked so well.
Yeah, yeah.
You constantly would have to stop. Every 11 minutes, stop, reload, and so forth. It just would have been really difficult.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. It looks like a totally lethal place to be. I'm surprised that the credits, it doesn't say in loving memory of, because... Man, yeah, yeah. There's looked like some pretty hairy moments.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was exciting at the same time. It was incredibly exciting, but at first incredibly intimidating. But, with time, it just, the whole game slowed down. The planes became less scary. You kind of felt your way around. You knew where you were going. And eventually we just got used to it.
So, I mean, you were all had to be quite cramped in together. And how did that work, filmmaking and also, all living together in the same room, essentially?
Right. We lived in my room. There were six of us. The other room, there were the other boys' room, there were eight of them. And then the ladies had, I think, seven or eight people. So we lived in the officers' quarters, which sounds fancy, but it really isn't. It was very cramped. And just from a production level, the thing that was really hard was the Navy did not give us, we hoped that we would get an extra room for our gear, and we didn't have that. So it was really a headache. We had a lot of gear. We did bring a lot of, different lighting equipment, we had a 7-foot jib. So we had quite a few pieces that we all needed to stuff in different corners of the room. So just the maintenance of the gear in those tight areas was a headache. Living together for so long, it just kind of brings you back to camp, or it brings you back to high school. And I enjoyed it, actually. At first, I was a little freaked out by the lack of privacy, or I thought I would be, but very quickly, I really enjoyed it. It was a very shared experience, and, all of us got really close as a result of it.
Yeah. There's actually a great scene on board, the crossing the equator sort of ceremony. Everyone has to get up and have a bit of a talent show, and the crew had to do one as well. And you can't, it's not on the series, but it is online. There's a little mini doco on all of you guys doing your piece.
Yeah. The captain called us every night at 6 o'clock. The captain would do what's called a captain's call thing. And he would give a brief message about the day, the flight, how the flight pattern, the flight schedule went, and this and that, the training. And then that, 7 or a week before that, Crossing of the Equator, he said there will be a talent show and we expect the Icon film crew to take part. So 5,000 sailors heard this, so there was no way we couldn't do this. So we had to come up with a skit. And we actually came in third. There was a bit of like, I don't know, some kind of voting system. And we came in third place. I don't know how that happened, but it was fun. It
but
was
as
great.
You say, they really welcomed you. They really, really welcomed you back.
Yeah, they did. It was odd. When we first came, a lot of people were skeptical, and the sort of upper officers were a little bit. They weren't quite sure how they should behave in front of cameras. You know, so it was, and just all across, there was a little bit this awkwardness. You know, but we worked our way in there. And then when we left, we had a 1 month break in the middle. We left in Kuala Lumpur and flew home for a month, and then flew back to Bahrain and the Gulf, got back on the ship. And then as soon as we got back, it was strange. It was almost like they missed us and they were just happy that we were back on board, or like we were part of the whole, you know, the deployment. And they were, it seemed like they really opened up their arms. And after that, I mean, the stories just took off. The characters really took off. You could really feel like we hit the ground running, and the stories were working, and it was great. And we were used to the conditions of the ship. You know, the first 10 days were one of the most stressful times in my life on the job, because the conditions of the ship are incredibly harsh. It's very loud. It's very, there's no privacy. And, you know, your body is just not used to this kind of thing. And when we came back, we, the filmmakers, were used to the ship. We knew our way around. We were used to the conditions, and they were used to us. So it was great. You know, we came back and we worked hard. So
what I love so much about the series is it's not a big boys' toys exercise. There's some truly honest and dramatic moments in there, which are probably almost more striking and more impactful, I think, than a lot of scenes in a lot of feature films.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think made that possible? What do you think made people open up so much and almost ignore the fact that you guys were around to a great degree?
Well, the director and executive producer, Mara, she wanted a show about the characters. She wanted a show about the sailors. And that's actually what the Navy liked. You know, there have been other shows on aircraft carriers and people concentrate on the planes and all on the technology of the aircraft carrier. And so the Navy really liked, you know, what the producers wanted to do. And that was our intention. Our intention was to tell a story about what it's like to be a sailor deployed on an aircraft carrier around the world. You know, the thing that I think happens all the time in documentary is it's amazing that you can be in a room with two people making love and there's a cameraman and a sound guy and they're not paying attention to you, you know, and I'm slightly exaggerating. That's never really happened to me. But yeah, that barrier just disappears and people just kind of forget you're there and they interact as if you're not in the room. And that didn't happen right away. But like I said, when they got used to us, when they began to get used to us, they would just forget about us. There's some people, I have to say, that never forgot about us, would always look over their shoulders. But there was very few of those people. Most people just forgot about us. And in some way, understood more and more as we were going along what we wanted to do and really said, okay, I'm in this. I've agreed to be in this. I can tell what you're trying to do. I'm going to help you do this. Yeah. You know?
So part of the whole being embedded there and just being no clock off time for you guys, there's no kind of going home in the shoot. You're always at the shoot. Would have actually probably been quite an interesting thing, the fact that at any given time you can just grab your camera if the light's great or an amazing sunset or something's happening when the camera wraps and normally would go home that you guys never missed, I guess.
Yeah, no, we were there, you know. Obviously it created a situation where after about 2-3 weeks we had to have a conversation about the schedule, and we came up with a schedule that worked. You know, roughly speaking, it was 5-day weeks, one full day off, 2 half-day offs at the discretion of the producers, so they could decide during the 7 days when they would give us that time off.
Right.
And we worked generally 10 to 12 hour days. But yeah, if things, really exciting things were happening, obviously, like there was one scene, it's called A Night of the Pitching Deck.
Yeah.
We were somewhere around the southern part of the Indian Ocean near Australia, and these enormous swells happen. And, you know, there had been 10 or 11 planes that went up around 5-6 o'clock in the evening, and they couldn't land because the deck was going up and down 35 feet in both directions. And, you know, which is an enormous problem with all the technology. There comes a point where it's up to the pilot and his ability to land a plane and not about the technology. So, you know, some of us weren't working at that time. And of course, when something like that happened, everybody picked up their cameras and started shooting. You know, what was exciting was that we kind of all sort of had an idea where we were going. You know, I was on the deck. There was a team that was following the Admiral around. So immediately they went to the Admiral and followed him around. And then there was a team that was following pilots. So they went to the Black Aces and they spent time in their room and, you know, people watching the landings on the monitors and so forth. So we had, you know, people all over the place kind of covering this. And it was great. It's one of my favorite parts in the show.
No, it all come together really well. It was a fantastic, fantastic episode.
Yeah.
Sticking with the boys' own annual stuff. Let's talk about the aerials, which I think you got to do an awful lot of.
Well, we shot with a Westcam off San Diego. You know, that's to get like the beautiful, perfect shot of the Nimitz. You know, they came from the front, from the back, from the side, et cetera, et cetera. But they did the same thing when we came back to San Diego 6 months later to get the really classic shots. Then inside the cockpit, we had a small lipstick camera that we put sort of in front of the pilot, pointing straight at him. And it was recorded on a Toshiba deck put together by this guy, Eric Wagenberg, who kind of specializes in this. And it was mini DV. And it was pretty rudimentary. It was mini DV. And the pilots actually had to press the record button themselves because we didn't...
Yeah, they didn't have much to do.
Well, yeah, no, actually, they don't have that much. Once they're up there, they're kind of they're looking around and this and that. The other thing, actually, speaking of the pilot, is those guys sometimes fly for so many hours and they record a lot of video. They have video cameras with them. They have them sort of in their small bags. They pull them out and they record a lot of video. So they were quite video savvy, you know. So if we told them, you know, will you, you know, go shoot this or that, they did it, you know. So I mean, there was never a time when somebody forgot to press the record button, you know. And we did this over and over and over, you know, for months. And then underneath the plane, you know, we wanted a view of underneath the actual plane when the plane lands on the ship.
Yeah.
So what happened is that Boeing built this kind of cage that had the same hookups that the Navy uses to hook up their fuel containers to the bottom of the jet. And in that, we put a Sony 1080i interlaced camera. It was an HD camera, 1080i. I don't remember the model name. And it was basically just this orange box with a window in the front. You know, we would turn on the button, they would go up in the air, and it was great. It worked really well. You know, obviously that kind of stuff, we needed like real people to mount that and design that for us. So that's what happened there.
And there's a lot of night vision on the deck too, a lot of night landings.
Yeah, you know, we quickly realized a lot of their work happens at night. They fly from, you know, sunset till 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, so a lot of our story content was happening at night. You know, at first I went out with my 500 ASA film and I shot it with a prime lens wide open and we got something, you know, but it was not going to work again to tell story, to really follow pilots around coming off the planes and this and that. So we found this place, it's called Electrophysics in Fairfield, New Jersey, and they gave us an astroscope night vision lens, and it basically fits between the body and the lens. It's a screw-on for the two-thirds bayonet mount or something. It worked great. At first, I thought, you know, it's like, is it visually, will people get into, you know, really get into the character if suddenly you're going to green material? But, you know, as they say, if you have an image and you can hear the sound, people will follow the story, you know? So it really worked. You know, the lens is difficult to use because it's so bright. So your eye is looking at something that's incredibly bright. So you have to crank down the viewfinder. So from an operating point of view, it's quite annoying, actually. But I think, you know, like the scenes of the night of the pitching deck were amazing because, you know, we got the pilot, the last guy who landed after these pilots have been trying to land for over an hour and a half, you know, basically risking their lives to try to land on this deck, which is going up and down. We got the guy, the last guy who landed, coming off the plane. He had refueled all the planes in midair and so forth. You know, and the emotion that was with him, that he carried when he came off that plane, you know. So we had a lot of scenes that needed to be completed. And if we didn't have the night vision lens, we wouldn't have been able to complete the scenes if we hadn't been able to shoot up there, you know.
So what about the workflow on board? Obviously, you've got a lot of footage. What do you do with it? I mean, you can't just sort of stack it all in the corner.
Right. We basically, you know, you don't want to ship your originals, so we made clones. We kept the clones on board. there were people coming on and off the ship. For example, Mara, you know, would fly on the ship for about 6 weeks, and then she would go back to New York and do business there, and then she would come back, and other people as well, and so forth. So whenever somebody would leave, they would take the originals with them while we kept the clones. When the originals arrived in New York, if somebody else would leave, they would take the clones and so forth. So we were kind of piecemealing the tapes off the deck, off the ship. In New York, they were digitized, obviously, and then the editors started. There were five. It was a 10-part series. There were five editors. They each edited two parts. The post was done by Postworks here in New York, you know, and they basically, yeah, they cut the 10 hours together.
The editing took a while.
It did take a while. It took somewhere like between 10 months and 14 months, something. I would say about a year. You know, Icon is a large company. It was produced by Icon, Mel Gibson, and they're a serious company. So they, you know, obviously they looked at it. And then the other piece was that the Navy looked at it. You know, the Navy, they had an agreement that the production had final cut. The Navy could not tell them what to cut, but, you know, you are dealing with the U.S. Navy, so they did kind of push and push, you know, and you know, in the process, Mara and the other producers, and Jeff Dupre and Deborah Dixon, everybody got to know people quite well, such as the admiral and the captain, and when you know people that well and they're kind of leaning on you, you know, it's difficult to really stick to your guns, but I have to say...
I would find it quite hard with the admiral of the Navy leaning on me.
Yeah, I mean, Mara told me a story that at one point there were 11 Navy officers who showed up in the editing room and wanted to see all 10 parts. And that includes the admiral and the captain, you know, and on down. And they sat there for 10 hours and watched every single episode. So that's a little stressful, you know?
Yeah. I believe in the end, they only actually cut about 30 seconds out, just from a security point of view, of areas that shouldn't have been filmed.
Yep, that's right.
But essentially, they didn't, you know, apart from that, it's warts and all, isn't it? There really is no holding back from anybody.
Yeah, no, there's not. And yeah, there was a map that was shot. They didn't want that for security purposes to be in. And, you know, later on, we had a screening in New York, and a lot of people showed up, and from the Navy, actually. And, you know, people asked, so what do you think? And they were really happy with it. They were very proud of it. And they just said, you know, great job. They were very pleased. And there are definitely some scenes that are politically not so correct.
Yeah, I mean, there's stuff there essentially where sailors are comparing it to near enough to prison.
Yeah.
Yet I'm sure it's probably done a fantastic job on Navy recruitment.
I think so. That's what I've heard. I mean, they in the end, they looked at it and they thought this will do well for Navy recruitment. And I think it has. I mean, I don't know the figures, but yeah.
Obviously, props to Mara Chermayeff, the director, who did a fantastic job. She also did the equally great Frontier House.
Yes, right, yeah.
How's it working with her? She would have been quite fantastic.
Yeah, she's amazing. Mara has an incredible intuitive sense for character and storytelling. And I think it comes from her love of people, a love of character, you know. And, you know, she just... I mean, you can see it in her eyes. She gets into these characters and she just can see their story. She really gets into it. I mean, I learned so much from her, you know, purely from this kind of developing of character sense. And also, you know, how to carry scenes, how to cover scenes. I remember there was one scene we shot. There's a young lady. She's about 20 years old. And she's in a review board because she got drunk in Hong Kong or something like that. You know, she's comes into the room and there's five guys there who are just, you know, getting it into her. You know, do you realize what you've done? Do you realize you could be thrown out of the Navy? And this woman is terrified. You know, she's just terrified. And Mara sees that she has a nail that she's, you know, scratching into her nail, that it's about to bleed, you know? Mm. And she just tapped me on the shoulder and she goes, look at a nail. And so I panned down and I got a close-up of a nail. And it just says so much about the scene. And, you know, so visually she really thinks. She sits in a room and she sees the character. She knows where she wants to be and how to cover a scene. So, and then she has the vision of the overall thing. You know, going back to like the beginning of the series, you know, there was talk about shooting it on mini DV and things like that. And, you know, one of the reasons I think this show, if it had been shot on smaller cameras, wouldn't have worked as well is not just because of the format and what you're actually getting. You're getting a smaller resolution image and so forth. But it's also, but the Varicam obviously is a shoulder mounted camera, you know, and when you're putting a camera on your shoulder, you're making far different decisions in terms of framing than you do when you're holding a camera kind of on your chest level, you know? And I think it's a much more cinematic look. You're getting over the shoulders. It's much easier to get over the shoulders to get in tight into people's faces. And so they wanted, they told us immediately, they wanted a very cinematic look. Yeah. And I think some other people might have just said, you know what, it's a crowded environment, it's difficult to shoot, there's a lot of stairs, it's a lot to carry, why don't we just shoot it on MIDI DV, you know? So, and with the logic that you can get into small rooms, you know, we were carrying a lot of gear around and we would walk into the room. And like I said earlier, at first people were a little bit jarred by a sound guy, you know, with a guy carrying a camera on his shoulder and so forth. But, you know, they wanted a cinematic look. It was totally worth it, you know.
If you were wanting to be stealthy and you were in a short-term sort of project, I guess you would say, let's shoot it with mini DV and or shoot it with, you know, the newer still cameras that can do video so people aren't so conscious of the camera. But I guess having such a long shoot, people just didn't care about the cameras eventually.
Yeah, no, people just got used to us. You know, we would walk into very sensitive environments and, you know, at first they're like, oh, there goes the film crew. And then they would just forget about us. But, you know, again, like to me, you know, when I shoot, the framing is so important. And, you know, the fact that you're shooting with a camera that is on your shoulder, is the framing is just much different than if you're shooting with a still camera that, you know, it kind of floats in the air a little bit. Or even if you're holding it high up, it's just the whole framing is completely different, I find.
Interesting.
And I do think that in this whole technological development, that conversation has been completely lost. You know, people are very excited that the cameras are getting smaller and smaller and that the resolution is getting better and better. But I think they forget that, you know, to operate a camera sort of on chest height creates a completely different operating situation.
Yeah.
You know, the camera kind of floats. If you're holding a DVX or an HVX 200 camera, so the camera tends to kind of float a little bit. So I think that, you know, it's much more cinematic in the sense that a lot of, you know, features are operated on tripods a lot and sort of on the level, on the, you know, the level of people's heads as opposed to being low shooting up.
There is something psychologically different about watching a scene through the viewfinder.
Absolutely. Exactly. I mean, you know, little decisions, if you're shooting a conversation between two or three people, and you're, you know, at eye level, you know, you can play a little bit with the focus. You can, you know, you can do little tricks coming around somebody's head and then revealing the other person. You know, there's just these sort of elegant things that you can do, which I think are much more difficult to do or almost impossible to do with a camera that's being operated from sort of waist level.
So what's next for you, Axel? A second tour of duty?
No, I don't know. I don't think I would. I'm not sure if I would do another one.
Well, you are working on something similar at the moment, and you're working with Mara again.
Yeah, I'm working on, she's doing a 6-part series for PBS on a circus, the Big Apple Circus in New York. We've been following the circus for about almost a year now. And I started the project and then I left the project because I had a shoulder problem, so I couldn't keep shooting. But I go back and I shoot the sit-down interviews, you know, and various other things for them sometimes. I've sort of dipped in and out of the project. It's a beautiful project, so I'm a little bit sad I wasn't able to stay on it.
So how can people find you? Websites, etc.
My website is axelbauman.com. That's axelbauman.com. My reel and my resume and so forth is on there.
Fantastic.
You know, I'd love to hear from people. I'm always excited to you know, work in different projects and so forth. So
fabulous. Well, look, thank you for talking today. I really appreciate it. I'm incredibly jealous beyond all you can know. It would have been fantastic to be on board. It would have been a very hard shoot, but a really rewarding one. And thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for talking with me.
Cheers.
Okay, well, that was a great interview, Jace. Thanks for that. And I must say, the whole idea of being out at sea and, you know, like your agenda is one thing, but the agenda of the entire military that you're with is a completely different one. Yeah. You know, my father's ex-Navy. He was actually Royal Navy, and right. I have a lot of time for the Navy. That would be the armed forces of my
Yeah, look, I really, really am jealous of the adventure, actually. I think from having done years of advertising, I just relish anything that involves not being
not being in a kitchen watching someone eat breakfast cereal, or being in a white psych or a green screen all day. So I was incredibly jealous of the adventure, the incredible, very taxing adventure this would have been to shoot. So.
Well, look, we've run over it. We apologise. We had every intention of making a short episode, but we haven't done it. You can check us out on the Twitters, where, Jason, you are?
I'm twitter.com/Wingrove, and as always, my website, jasonwingrove.com.
Show notes are over at fxguide.com. Up the top, you'll see a podcasting section, and there's a pull-down for the Red Centre page where you can download these episodes if you're not actually already doing that already, but also the show notes. If you are listening to this via iTunes, of course, then that's quite a useful resource to go over and tap into. As always, I'm on Twitter as Mike Seymour, and we just loved hearing your feedback, and you guys send us emails at red@redcenter.com. And I've got to tell you, we have a really active, every week we probably get like a dozen emails from people, and I'd say 99.9% of them are really intelligent and often telling us things we didn't know. So, please keep that coming. We love it.
We will catch up with a bit of emailing. We've got a lot of questions that people have answered. Most of the time we'll actually reply in person, but also if we think it's worthwhile, we'll put it all in a bit of in one whole package, and we'll try and answer a lot of that stuff on air, so to speak. So, yeah, please Reddit. That's red@fxguide.com.
Okay, and we also want to do a shout-out to Matt Graham, who's our producer and who does the editing on the show. We don't ever thank Matt enough, but he slaves away doing that, and it's obviously a whole crew that provides stuff for this, so we do appreciate the guys' help. So thank you, guys. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour.
I'm Jason Wingrove. Thanks, guys.
See you, guys.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC.